Welcome back to the Age Stage, and we have with us Dr. Leung, who is conducting a trial at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre. Welcome along, Dr. Leung.
Thank you, Vicky, for having me.
Can we call you Dr. Deborah?
Of course you can. You can even call me Deborah if you want.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Deborah sounds so sophisticated. Welcome to our show. Lovely to have you.
It's nice to have you here.
Now, you're doing a trial, we believe, on advanced care planning there at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre. Can you outline what that actually means for us, Deborah?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not sure how aware your audience is about advanced care planning, but essentially what it is that it's a document that is the product of multiple different stages, and it essentially helps patients to outline their values and their beliefs and their goals about their life and their future medical treatment, so that in the event that they can't communicate to themselves, it means that their treating team, so their doctors and their nurses, can help to formulate the most appropriate medical treatment plans for them when they aren't able to speak for themselves.
Right, so this is pre-planning then, is that correct?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So the idea is really to try and get people to plan for the future. So in medicine, we always hope for the best and we try and provide everyone with the best treatment possible. But what we do want to do is be mindful of the fact that even though we do our very best, complications occur, you know, deterioration in health is a natural part of the aging process. And what we want to get people to do is to try and plan for those situations where in the event they become so ill that they can't speak for themselves, that we can help to formulate treatment plans that are in keeping with what that patient would have wanted. And so what we're really trying to do is there's been a lot of work about advanced care planning being done around the end-of-life care setting, and there's a lot of excellent work out there. But there's a big gap around what we would call the perioperative period or the time around surgery. And the time around surgery is really an important time to be talking about advanced care plans, but no one is really doing it, and that's for a variety of reasons. One of them is that we're obviously worried about causing distress to patients right before they go on to have major surgery. And the other big reason is that people are worried that we might potentially talk people out of having surgery that they need. And so what our study is trying to do is really work out what the best way to talk about advanced care plans around the time of surgery is, so that we can get more people who are about to have major surgery doing one.
Right.
So if I was 75 years of age, I'm going to have a bowel section done. I'm going to be anaesthetized. I'm going to be put to sleep, and it's going to be quite invasive surgery. What conversation do we have?
Sure. So there's, do you mean with reference to advanced care planning? Or
Yes.
So what we would talk about is this would all be prefaced by a particular conversation about your specific medical context, so your other medical conditions, what the baseline risk for this kind of operation is, and then how that baseline risk is affected by you as an individual. So if you're an individual with not many medical problems, then you would probably be around that baseline risk of any complications or any sort of long-term effects of having a surgery like that. Whereas if you're someone with a lot more medical conditions, then the risk of complications or needing to stay in hospital for a prolonged period of time, or then eventually even needing to go into residential care or not being able to return to your previous quality of life goes higher. And so based on that risk and based on your individual risk profile, what we would then talk about is tell you what the components of an advanced care plan, and there are really three components of having one. One is to identify a surrogate decision maker. And that's probably the most important thing. And that is someone who you feel would be able to tell the doctors and the nurses what is important to you and sort of make a medical decision in line with what you would want. And it's not always the most obvious person. The people always say things like, oh, well, it's obviously my wife or my husband. But that's not always true because people have very different social situations and personal situations, and sometimes some people say, you know, my wife or my husband would find it very difficult to make a decision that I would want, which is that I potentially wouldn't want to have this kind of treatment or something like that, whereas my best friend Joe might be more able to make that decision. So they might appoint Joe as their surrogate decision maker rather than their wife or their husband. So It's firstly identifying that surrogate decision maker, and then the second component is discussing what things, what quality of life is important to you and what things in your life are important to protect. And then the third thing is then documenting down those wishes in a formalised advanced care plan. So we would tell you what the advanced care plan components are, so those three things, and then what we would do is give you the paperwork and then encourage you to spend some time talking to your family and your friends and the people that are important to you so that all of this is documented correctly, and then we get the get you to bring us back those components so that we have it on record so that in the event that anything, a situation does arise where it's useful, then we know where to find that information, and that's really crucial.
Because can that actually be connected to your digital medical records?
Yes, yeah, so it's a very good question. So one of the big problems that advanced care planning has faced is that it's all well and good making these very detailed plans and doing all these discussions, but if we can't find the information as treating clinicians, then there's no point having one. And there's now a big move to kind of get all these things done electronically. And what we're now sort of talking about within the advanced care planning sort of clinician and research circles is something called My Health Record. So that's something that's available online to everyone. You can go to myhealthrecord.gov.au and you can record or scan in a copy of your advanced care plan onto that record. And that record is slowly being rolled around to sort of all hospitals and healthcare facilities around Australia. So eventually we would hope that if you put it onto My Health Record, it would be accessible no matter where you went to for help or wherever you ended up.
And is this documentation, is that it's your wishes, so it's your final decision. Nobody else can override that, even though you've said, you know, my best friend Joe is the best person to make these decisions. Can family override your own wishes or what Joe may decide?
Yes, it's a difficult sort of question.
It's a legal minefield, isn't it?
Yes,
absolutely, and it's sort of more important in the light of the fact that there's new legislation coming in Victoria about advanced care planning, and it'll come into act probably in 2018, so next year. But there are essentially two, legally now there will be two types of advanced care plans. One of them is sort of a values directive, which is essentially what we've been talking about, and that's where you write down the things that are important and what your preferences would be. And mm-hmm. You aren't ever able to sort of, you can't dictate sort of medical treatment in an advanced care plan. Ultimately, what is appropriate medical treatment for a patient is always decided by, a multidisciplinary collaborative medical team.
Yes.
But the decisions we make are informed by the advanced care plan, and we use that to come up with the most appropriate treatment. So to respect what it says, but we don't. But it's not sort of it's not binding.
Right.
Right.
If though, as the obvious statement here is, do not resuscitate. Mm-hmm. Clause, which is in my own father's case, he had it as a statement of the way that he wanted to be. Unfortunately, it was in a bag next to his computer, and he'd already been resuscitated three times by the time anyone got anywhere near the bag. So that's why I asked the question about the digital information.
Yeah.
But if I request in that statement, if I request do not resuscitate, is that something that the medical practitioners are obliged to follow?
Yes, I think ethically we would be obliged to
right.
follow that.
Okay.
I'm probably not the best person to talk about legally whether we're obliged to do it, but almost universally, if that was if the advanced care plan was seen to be a valid advanced care plan, and there are obviously several components we look at to see whether it's valid, and it was strictly recorded that you didn't want resuscitation, then we would definitely follow that.
Will there be a pro forma, do you think, that will eventually fall out of this study?
A pro forma? Well, what we want to do is not necessarily come up with a pro forma, but we want to come up with an integrated model of advanced care planning where we can try and make it a part of the usual care process around patients having major surgery. And eventually down the track, we want it to become almost like, quite facetious. So we try and follow, like the quit smoking campaign, which is very, initiated a long time ago. And they used to have something called every patient, every encounter. And And we want to have a similar sort of thing where every time a patient comes in for any kind of major surgery or any kind of major crossroads in their health, that's the time that we bring up advanced care planning and give patients the opportunity to do this. And we don't ever want to force people to do it if they're not at a time where it's right for them or they're not ready to discuss these things. But the more times we ask, just in the same way, the more times you ask someone about smoking, the more likely they are to take up that opportunity. So we really owe it to our patients to at least keep offering it to them so that, you know, we give them that opportunity to kind of determine their own healthcare treatment down the future.
Without wanting to be cynical, the medical profession have never been particularly good when it comes to making a forthright decision for you. They say, well, you can have this or you can have that, and these are the potential outcomes that you need to be aware of. Now make the decision. And when all you really want to do is say, do you want me to do it or not? You know.
Yeah, absolutely. I 100% agree with that. And we often have the analogy that, you know, the same thing when you go and buy a fridge or a dishwasher. You don't want the salesperson to say, these are the options, you just pick one. You want them to tell you what is the best one for you.
Yes,
correct.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that sentiment. And what we're really trying to, what you're really describing is something that is gaining popularity amongst healthcare professionals, and it's something called shared decision making. And shared decision making is really where the doctor shares with the patient what the appropriate and available treatment options are for them, and then the patient in turn shares with the doctor what is important in their life and what quality of life they want to protect.
Yep.
And then together they make the best decision. And so what ideally we want is, as you said, the vast majority of patients want the doctor to tell them what the best thing to do is. And so if you tell us what the important things are that you value, so, you know, what you want your dishwasher to do or what you want your fridge to do, then we can say, based on what you're telling me about what's important to you and what you want out of this, you know, for instance, you want to be symptom-free or you want your pain to be better or you want your cancer cured. Based on what you tell us what you want, we can say, well, this sounds like this is probably the most appropriate treatment plan for you, and that's what I would advise. So we are trying to move towards that model, from which is exactly what you're describing in this thing called shared decision-making.
Fantastic.
Well, it sounds like a very interesting trial, Deborah. And you know, you're obviously in the midst of it, but it would be interesting to find out how that goes when the trial is completed there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'd love to keep you informed of the results of our trial, and hopefully based on this we'll be able to roll out sort of more what we would call evidence-based programs to help introduce it sort of more widespreadly throughout the state.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time. We do appreciate it.
Thanks very much. Thanks. Bye.
Welcome back to the Age Stage, and with us now we have Dr. Shulman. Can we call you Mark? Dr. Shulman.
Oh, absolutely.
Great. Now, Mark, you're at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre and you're...
I'm at the Alfred Hospital.
Alfred. Apologies. At the Alfred. And you're conducting a trial currently on predicting post-surgical outcomes and, in particular, looking for how those outcomes can impact quality of life. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we're conducting research specifically in older patients, so patients over the age of 70.
Right.
Looking at what things that might predict them having poor recovery or increased disability, or another way of saying that is a poor quality of life after surgery.
Right, so that it would be a different level of or quality of life than what they have prior to that surgery. That's the baseline you're trying to establish?
That's right.
Can you give us an example of what such a condition might be?
Absolutely. I mean, I guess an obvious example that springs to mind is if somebody has surgery and they might suffer a stroke as a consequence of that surgery, that may lead to some severe physical and perhaps emotional limitations that stop them being able to do the things they might have been able to do in the past.
But how would you... Other than say, well, you're 76 years of age, you've got a heart condition, you've been taking your tablets fairly irregularly. Other than that, how else could you put a marker on the likelihood?
Well, that's what we're attempting to determine.
Right.
These sorts of studies to trying to predict risk have been done before, but previous studies have looked at predicting specific problems such as stroke, heart attack, problems with kidney, that sort of thing. But the problem with those studies is, you know, a heart attack can be a very variable thing, can be quite mild, and perhaps you might not have any permanent consequences from it, right through to being quite disabling. So instead of trying to predict specific complications or problems with surgery, we're trying to predict having increased disability after surgery. So it doesn't matter so much matter what the complication is, but just that they'll have a poorer quality of life or increased disability after surgery. And we're looking at a range of things, from the sorts of things that you were describing. They might have a pre-existing medical condition or pre-existing problems with their function, through to different kinds of operations or even perhaps things that might happen after surgery. And looking at different things that might help us to predict people who are going to develop disability afterwards.
And so it's educating them prior to their surgery as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess one of the main aims is if we can predict those people who might have problems, it'll enable discussions between the patient's doctor and the patient and their family to talk about whether that surgery may or may not be appropriate for them, or perhaps they need to consider alternative treatments for the condition they might have.
Right.
But it also helps the anaesthetist and surgeons and other doctors in the hospital plan the level of care they might need when they go to hospital. For example, they might need some interventions to improve their health before they have surgery, or they might need an increased level of care, for example, intensive care after surgery.
Right.
So there are other things we can do to modify risk depending on what we think their risk might be.
So it's also to assist that whole journey being a little bit more well planned, for want of a better term. Is that what you're saying?
That's a perfect term. It's exactly right. We call it the perioperative journey, and planning that and being able to discuss it is very important.
Generally speaking, this is a question that's sort of from me more than anything else. At what age should I be much more aware of anaesthetic being a problem, generally speaking?
There are a couple of components to that question. One is, and the question assumes that it's the anaesthetic that's the risk.
Yes.
I'll deal with the first one. At what age? We know we don't know, but from the initial previous research we've done, we know that people over the age of 70 are more likely to have post-operative disability that can be long-term, up to 6 to 12 months afterwards. We haven't measured beyond that. But we didn't have enough people in that study to really be able to give an exact age. But the other thing about age is, age is important, the person's chronological age isn't necessarily as important as their general fitness and health. So you can have a very unhealthy 70-year-old, and you can have a very fit 70-year-old who can run a marathon, and they'll certainly have different risk. So age in itself isn't necessarily, exact age isn't necessarily completely predictive. The other thing about your question is, we don't really know whether it's the anaesthetic or the surgery itself that carries the most risk. It's very difficult to tease that out. And it's likely, it's probably a combination of the both and the body's reaction to the stress of having, you know, a major operation afterwards. Because most complications that happen do happen in the days to weeks after surgery rather than actually during the operation.
Surgery. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been fascinating, isn't it?
Yes, thank you very much.
And maybe, if we may, could we contact you perhaps in sort of 6 months' time or something and see how it's going?
Yeah, of course, no problem at all.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. The Age Stage is much the richer for your wonderful contribution.
You're very welcome, and thanks for inviting me to be on the show.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, there you go.
Another show down, Brody.
Well, yeah, it's getting close to that. I found that really, really interesting. In fact, the whole show's been interesting.
Oh, it has been. Yes. It's been very enlightening today.
It has. And welcome back. That was Amistad, a track called Parley, which was brought in by Lisa. It was a very nice track. I enjoyed that. That was. Where did you pick that up from? That was
from the Flower and Garden show, actually, on the weekend in Melbourne.
Flower and Garden. Well, there you go.
That was nice, actually. It was good.
Now we have a guest, a friend of yours, a colleague or a connection to you.
Oh, I think I'm safe enough to call him a friend.
Yes. Well, would you like to introduce him to us?
I would. Hello, Russell. Can you hear us?
I can, Lisa.
Are you pulled over on the side of the road in your car?
I am.
You are. And you've had a busy day today, I dare say.
Yes, it has been quite busy.
Ooh, goodness me. I think I caught a frog in my throat then, actually.
Are you right? No, I lost it. Okay, let's just have... You can have a cough. So, Russell, now, you are you involved with the Men's Shed? I believe you are, aren't you?
I'm involved in the Men's Shed through my work with Martin Dixon. So I'm the electorate office manager for Martin Dixon, who's a Member of Parliament for the Nepean electorate.
Right.
And we've been... I suppose involved with various Men's Sheds and projects and trying to help them get funding and do whatever we can to assist them over the last few years. So I'm relatively aware of the three that we've got in our patch.
Yep. Groups like that, how important are they in terms of the social fabric for us as a nation? They're obviously groups of volunteers, we get that, and they do good work. But from your perspective, how do you feel about the energy that they have for their own? In other words, like Men's Shed looking after their own kind, their own men, Probus looking after varying charities, mainly with women and so on. What's the political comprehension of the net worth of all of that to our society as a whole?
Men's Sheds fill a really important role. Mm. Particularly for men who have retired and also who may be on their own. And they're a demographic that don't normally ask or call out for much help, and they don't tend to have good networks of their own. And what the Men's Shed does is it provides a place where these guys can come together and just banter or make things or get involved in some community activity. It mostly revolves around doing something with their hands. And the ones that were then involved in, particularly Safety Beach Dramana, they had a great setup previously down at Don Bosco College, but they're just in the process of completing their brand new facility at the Manor Street tennis court space. And they did a lot of good work and a lot of making things. In fact, they had almost like a little cottage business going, doing furniture repair, and they would pick up things and then repair them and sell them and use that money to help fund themselves. They also would make a lot of smaller little knickknacks for schools and other charities, and they also had a program going into schools and just teaching kids the basics of woodwork and that sort of thing. And it was great for the older men to get back reconnected to community, because they might, you know, their partners might have passed away or this sort of thing, or they've ended up on their own, and they just become a forgotten class of people. So in terms of the overall health and well-being and mental health, particularly of that older demographic of men, it's the Men's Sheds have just been a godsend, to be honest.
Russell, I was just going to say, I must have got nervous talking to you on the phone, because it's, I think it's the first time I've actually got a bit chuffed up, actually, trying to talk to you. I was going to ask you a little bit more about the how the progression of the Sorrento, the Safety Beach Men's Shed, because when I was back in the day, when I was working at the Shire, they were very keen to actually get involved in building a men's shed, and they were looking for a site at that particular point in time,
yep.
because I think they were made homeless from the Don Bosco camp for whatever reason. And how are things progressing there now?
Look, the shed is up, and it's fairly well completed. It's not fitted out inside, as I understand, but I went past there today as I was running down the freeway, and I did see some various apparatus there doing work. But I think they're planning on having a formal opening around September. And so we've got a bit of internal fit-out with, you know, kitchens and some internal walls and that sort of thing. So we've been very, very well progressed. Yep.
Have you moved?
You've moved. We've lost
you. You were very clear, and then suddenly you were not. You weren't.
No.
That's better.
You went into space.
I think there was a tram went by about 50 metres away.
There you go. Now, this is the conundrum. And it ties back to the political sphere, I think, to some extent. And that is, We have a men's shed here. They produced a, we've just been discussing it, they produced for a young girl who had some disability, a sort of high chair that she could climb up onto so that she could chop food with her mother and all that sort of thing. And it had a cage, not a cage, but it had a protective rail all around her.
Yep.
And it was very well built, and it was nice and solid and all the other bits and pieces, and it was made to what was assumed would be a sort of the right shape. And it was, you know, but no one actually sat down and said, well, if the girl weighs 65 kilos and she leans to the left over for a pop, then you're going to need an ergonomic base of XYZ, which then raised the issue that if she did, in fact, climb into that and she did lean out to get something and did hit a pan of fat and did get burnt, then the men's shed is potentially culpable for things like that. And so the question was asked, and it wasn't, they said, well, that would better be the last we make of that, because we don't want to get into that sort of trouble. How do we remove that fear of liability for these groups?
Well, it's really a question for a lawyer, I think, rather than yeah. me, but generally my understanding of manufacturing or a business that makes things,
yes,
is that they do have a form of insurance that they can take, which is a, you know, public professional liability on those sort of products. But look, that's really a question for a lawyer or a specialist in that field. The men's shed generally, you know, that's a fairly specialised piece of equipment. I'd be surprised if they were making it, but
it was a request that came through from a family that said, my daughter would love to help me cook. Can you do something? And it was that level of innocence and instant response said, yes, let's do it.
Yes.
And then, of course, not that anything happened, but then as soon as the question was raised that there was a potential fear factor, then that raises the issue. And it's not just the legal sense. I think that socially, even within the fabric of our everyday society, I think we're getting to a point where when people can't or choose not to do things because they may find themselves in legal trouble, then I think we've gone a step too far. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's, within the political realm of local, state and federal government, I'm sure there'd be, you know, common ground to try and work out a solution. But at the end of the day, the lawyers are the ones that would advise on that sort of thing. And because the men's shed is an entity, and is it a business, is it not? I mean, there's all sorts of questions that are a bit beyond my scope to really get to the bottom of. But certainly if there was a potential for liability, then the men's shed association, which is a I think a national organisation, they're quite well structured, I'm sure they'd be able to come to that, because I would be fairly confident that question's come up a bit before. So
it certainly has, I think. The men's shed does have insurance. There's no question that it doesn't, because it costs a lot of money for them to have that level of insurance. That's in essence, that's not, although it is the issue, but they wouldn't want to end up being placed in that environment, and so they chose not to do any more in that space. And I think that is sad. When we can't help people, when we can't stand up and say, yes, I can put that light bulb in for you without carrying $10 million worth of personal liability, I think that then it's, as I say, it's getting a step too far.
You would think so, but I think also that sort of specialised equipment is almost going a little bit beyond, I think, the overall purpose of the men's shed. And what I've noticed in being involved or, you know, visiting, is watching basically groups of blokes getting around their work centre or whatever, or getting around the coffee table, and just bantering and just having a bit of fun as blokes do when we get around each other. You know, it was nothing, you know, sinister or bad or anything.
No.
It was just really good fun, and it was just a great banter and camaraderie around the table. And, I mean, I've spent my life really working in construction and on building sites, and did quite a bit of time in factories making things, and I understand how that dynamic works, and it was really pleasing to just see these guys who normally are disconnected. They come together once or twice a week, and they just have that opportunity to just banter around the table and do a bit of work at the same time and actually do some good for the community. And I think that's probably the point that is really, I think, more relevant with the men's sheds. I think if they're starting to get into areas of manufacture which are creating liabilities, then I think we're missing the point with the benefits of a bench shed, to be honest.
I absolutely agree with you, Russell, and I think it's important to actually recognise the health and wellbeing benefits of men's shed and the fact that it actually does promote cohesiveness and a collective sense of well-being, where you've got a group of gentlemen that are probably, you know, may have retired and lost the, you know, lost the sense in terms of the shifting from, you know, full-time meaningful employment and going into a space that's otherwise known as a bit of leisure time. How do you find meaningful engagement when your work colleagues might have been your only contact, and now you're sort of stepping off that platform and into the other sphere, stratosphere of, you know, social entities, and how do you then connect with other people? And I think men's sheds do that beautifully, and I think that they, you know, the product at the end of the day, if they're building something, inevitably, you know, it will be what it will be, whether it's high risk or low risk, but ultimately I think the goodwill and the actual premise of men's sheds far outweigh any harmful, potential harmful impact that they might have in the community. And I think that, you know, they're a brilliant idea, and it's be nice to be able to see them prop up sort of everywhere, really, in terms of, yeah.
I couldn't agree more. And look, we've had, you know, examples where, you know, given to me, where, you know, men have come into a men's shed environment who have been, you know, fairly isolated and suffering from depression, and they've been on medication, and and after a year or so of just rebonding and building a friendship network back again, and as blokes doing it while they're actually physically making something, rather than having to sit around a table and talk to each other, they, it's just that loose, more conversation that happens around the work table.
And the sharing of skill, you find the most incredible depth of skill.
Absolutely. Well, they've found experiences where some of these men have actually been able to go off or dramatically reduce their medication because they're actually not as depressed anymore. And, you know, I mean, they're really heartening stories, and I think that's the overall health and wellbeing benefit of a men's shed. And, you know, they're open to anyone. I mean, the ones I've spoken to have said that, you know, they're happy if women wanted to come along as well, if they would. But it is really more an environment, you know, for blokes and generally older blokes. And some of us younger ones that have got a few tools that they don't use anymore, we're usually more than happy to donate them in there and lend a bit of a hand if we could too.
Absolutely.
And some of the other little projects they might make and do for kids and make toys and things like that. I mean, these are, you know, things which are very zero liability impact, really.
Russell, it's been great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for giving your time. It's we greatly appreciate it, and thanks you very much, Lisa, for inviting Russell along. It's been a great asset to the program.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Russell, for coming along.
Bye.
Good on you, Lisa. Bye-bye.
We've got Paula Dunn with us now, and we're going to let her have a few words with us. So, Paula, you're a psychotherapist, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Can you explain exactly what a psychotherapist is and does?
A psychotherapist is a counsellor,
right?
So an analyst. So people come to me with their issues and problems, which are many and varied.
Yes.
And, I help them from a psychological point of view as holistically as I possibly can.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And have you been doing this for many years?
I have been doing it for well over 20 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Long time.
Mm. Gosh.
Saved many a marriage, I would have guessed.
That's
part of it.
It's quite interesting. That's a bit of an oxymoron with me, considering I'm divorced. But, yeah, yes, it's my area of expertise is couple therapy. I really like it.
Yeah.
Mm.
Mm. Now, with older people... I'm glad we are going to get television in here.
Yes, I think we do.
It is coming, Brody.
That would be worth the Facebook Live seeing that one.
With older people, when they enter that phase in life, retired and what have you, do their problems change? Because for a start, they're suddenly living in probably in great proximity once again, which is... You know, they're retired, they're both living at home and under each other's feet. I would have thought that was a starting point for...
It can be. I think the main issue I see is isolation and the lack of socialisation, which is where lifestyle villages are fantastic, I think, to encourage that social activity, because one can become really depressed, and by depressed I mean, they start to ruminate and focus on the past events, mm-hmm. How maybe they could have done things better or not so, or they become very anxious about what might happen, what could happen in the future for them, health-wise or family conditions, whatever it might be. So when they're on their own, they can either be in one or other of those states, depressed or anxious. And I think when you're in a village or a lifestyle village situation, you're far more, that's far more able to be identified from people, from the receptionist to the maintenance man, as the guys were talking about, to be people coming to visit. And you've got to remember too, a lot of people don't have family.
Yes. Has there been studies to sort of show like general population, you know, in older seniors, that feeling of isolation, that percentage of those suffering depression versus those within a community such as a retirement village, etc.?
I'm not aware of a particular study. I don't know if you guys are.
Yeah,
there have been.
Absolutely.
A lot of anecdotal studies done about people who choose to live in the village environment have a longer life, but more importantly, less health issues for that. In fact, I think there was a New Zealand study done.
You'll have to move in a bit closer, guys.
There was a New Zealand study done some years ago where they quantified it by saying about 5 years on average, people who chose living versus the average age of those who passed.
Right.
The village people were living up to 5 years longer.
Up to 5 years longer.
And that
because of that network and that
last little while of their lives were their major health issues. The balance of their lives were lived fairly health issue free.
Right.
And it makes sense. I mean, I think it does anyway, because the killer in my view, is stress. And
absolutely.
A village environment is pretty close to a stress-free environment, isn't it? There's no such thing as a stress-free environment, but villages go jolly close.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know.
Stress is a good motivator, though, too. I mean, I don't think we can ever eliminate stress from our lives completely. I mean, stress is what gets us out of bed in the morning. You know, we've got to meet certain, you know, requirements or deadlines or pay the mortgage or whatever it might be.
Yes.
It's when it becomes distress.
Yeah, but I'm thinking, rather than stress, anxious is a good word.
Anxious is a much better word.
Absolutely, anxious.
I'm sort of meaning anxious.
Yeah, definitely.
Anxious and fearful.
Yeah. And once again, it's learning strategies to be able to handle that.
Absolutely.
And cope with those things.
And half the thing is creating a good environment,
yes.
You know, where people are encouraged to be positive about their future, their life, and so on.
Yeah, on a day-to-day basis in a village lifestyle. Yeah.
And that's the environments we try and create.
Yes.
From emotional and a physical perspective, that's what we do. The whole downsize takes the physical stress out of things.
Mm.
Your emotional well-being and your outlook on life's based around quality of time, quality of the people around you, and good planning for your future and having something to live for. And we go to great lengths to encourage people to do it. Now, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink.
No, you can't.
Yes, that's quite right.
And my attitude is that we'll do everything we can to allow you to have a great life and finish well, but it's still up to you to take up the challenge and get on with it.
Yes, exactly. Once again, in a lifestyle environment, if things are going really pear-shaped for that person, that individual, it can be identified.
Absolutely.
A lot faster than if they were just living on their own at home and Meals on Wheels were coming in once a day or whatever. I had an interesting experience when I went to visit Mountain View at Leongatha.
It's a very good village, isn't it? Mountain View.
The lovely Rose, who was Matt Rosa, who's the manager down there.
The gorgeous Rosa.
Took me and showed me around, and she was saying how we went to the community hub part, you know, and she was saying how they all come up for happy hour, which is supposed to be at 5 o'clock, but they start coming up at 3:30.
That's my kind of happy hour.
I thought that was fairly positive.
Blowing the service fee budget a couple of times, that's for sure.
Because they're wanting to get together.
Have a chat, have a drink.
Mind you, those views are pretty good.
Play some pool.
Those views are pretty good.
Yeah, they are good.
They're pretty nice.
Yeah.
What about marital relationships at the senior part of life? It's a different paradigm, isn't it?
It is, companionship.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that you're there to care for each other. And that's not to say that, you know, our sexual desires stop. They certainly do not. And, you know, couples can go on well into their, you know, late 80s, 90s, having a really fulfilling sexual life, you know. Yeah.
There's hope for us, Pete. There's hope for us, buddy. Hey.
So, yeah.
No, it is true.
I think it's a very important topic because it's one of those things that, you know, a lot of people go, ugh. You know, yes. They don't when you're 17, but you know, and that's wrong. It just doesn't make sense. But do you, as a counsellor, do you find that people moving into that sphere of life, the pressure of suddenly being retired, the days come and all that sort of, it must be a difficult phase.
It is, and it's a process that they need to work through. I have a couple at the moment that I'm working with, and that's happened exactly like that. He's retired, she has had her life doing what she does, and he's all of a sudden arrived on a 24-hour basis. So she needs to get used to that. She needs to become patient with him as he transitions through to that, you know, that same sort of living. And at the same time, he needs to respect what she already is experiencing.
And that's where you come in to give him the necessary tools and skills to be able
Absolutely.
To...
Absolutely. So they would come to me as a couple, and it's like going back to the beginning, okay, what attracted you to this person? You know, and we go through the whole process. I'll give them a lot of homework, a lot of practical work, and you can see it actually unfolding again and the flame starts again, and it's really rewarding to see them reignite.
Yeah. That's lovely.
Yeah.
Because I and then, of course, you'll end up with one of them is going to go first, whoever, and then that raises a whole new level of loss and lack of independence because you've never been independent or you can't remember when you last were.
Yes, exactly.
And one of the almost the tragedies of a deep and abiding partnership is the fact that you are so connected that when one of you inevitably does go, the other one loses a great chunk of their who they are.
They do. That's right.
That would take some skill unbundling that for them, I would think.
It does, but there's a difference between being connected and being codependent. Codependency is a real ogre to watch out for. You know, like husband might think, you know, he's doing absolutely all the right things by doing everything for wife, and something happens to him and she is left absolutely in no man's land.
Yeah. Right, because she
And you wouldn't think it would happen these days, but it absolutely does.
Right.
And vice versa. You know, I have a couple that I see, she has never been into a bank since they married. Gosh. And they're only in their 60s. You know, now something happened to him. She has no idea of where to start, what to do. I'm sure she would get the guidance eventually, but so codependent.
Do you have a card, Paula? Do you have a card?
I do.
That's a loving, isn't it? Well, look, I applaud the fact that, that you work with the station and you give us some of your time, which you do, as your capacity in giving advice to people, do you have rooms or do you, like a doctor does, is that?
I have a practice from home.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So people come and see me, I've got a specific room.
How does that work for you?
It works really well for me. It works really well. Yeah. Right. And it seems to bother other people, but it certainly doesn't bother me. It gives me total autonomy. You know,
and do you prefer to see people in your space, or do you?
Yes, because I create my own environment,
right.
And that's very important to me. And people, everyone I see, I give them a feedback form when I finish with their therapy, and everybody says the same thing, that they felt so relaxed, so safe. And, you know, and very comfortable.
Is it also then, as a couple, if they're going to your place, that it's like neutral ground? That it's not in their own environment.
That's
how I'm seeing it, is that you're going to a different set of four walls.
Yes, definitely. So I can, you know, there's someone totally objective dealing with them, and there are rules you know, and they must not talk over the top of each other, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
And they're, you know, they each give their undivided opinion of what's going on, and then we work from there.